and he got it, put it on the floor, and ran over it with his chair.
I get quite a kick from just seeing a record that I've plugged get on playlist. One of the fans was so excited, she actually threw up over the reception desk.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Bob Herman.
Music came into my life in that early 60s. I'd been listening to my mum's music collection. She used to love the Everly Brothers and slightly earlier than that, Bill Haley and the Comets and people like that. And then onwards, I got my first Danzette record player in 1963. And then I bought, when I got the Danzette, I bought three records. Everybody remembers the first records they bought. They were 6 and 8 pence each. I bought three for £1. And I bought Do Do Run Run by the Crystals, Atlantis by the Shadows, and I Like It by Jerry and the Pacemakers. So I was just built up my record collection from there.
We're with you all weekend, every weekend, 24 hours on Spark Radio. It's 25 afternoon.
I remember when I first got an interest in the radio side of things was we went on holiday to the Isle of Man in 1964, and moored just off the Isle of Man was Radio Caroline North, which, and the shops in Douglas where we stopped, and I think in Ramsey as well when we went up to there, one or two of the shops were stocking Radio Caroline merchandise, as in the only merchandise you could get were T-shirts, I suppose. But I bought a Radio Caroline T-shirt and I listened for 2 weeks to Radio Caroline sort of while we were there and thought it was fantastic. So then came home, and obviously in the middle of England in landlocked Birmingham, you wouldn't hear anything of any pirate really, north or south. But I got listening to Radio Luxembourg as it faded in and out, so I obviously always remembered listening to that as well. I can't play a note, by the way. I can't play a note. I've tried to play a guitar, keyboard, whatever. I'm useless. My interest in collecting records, buying records, continued. I was very excited when Radio 1 launched in 1967.
Radio 2, Radio 1, go!
Towards the end of the 60s, I left school, 68. Didn't know what I wanted to do, ended up at the electricity board as an accounts trainee, really boring. Towards the end of January 73, there was an advert in the Birmingham Evening Mail that CBS Records were opening a regional office in Birmingham and they were looking for a regional office assistant. So I thought, wow, CBS Records. Oh, I was just thinking, actually, in my head, free records, you see. So I had the interview, didn't hear anything for a week or so, then got a phone call saying, could we see you for a second interview? I thought, wow. So I said, yeah, where do you want me to go? And they said, well, we'll come to your house. Where do you live? So I was still living at my mum and dad's, so my mum and dad sort of went into the back room. I was in the front room where the Grundig stereogram was, and I thought, I'll really impress them, because by that point, Radio Birmingham, BBC Radio Birmingham was on the air, and I was an avid listener, actually.
And hello, I'm the Ross bit of the Ross and Henry Show.
And on this groovy Saturday morning, you're listening to John Henry and to Leslie Ross. Stay tuned, because there's more good sound to come.
Particularly to Tony Butler's 5 o'clock Friday evening sports show. And I was a prize winner on that show.
Right, well, my champagne quiz question's very difficult this week. I'm giving you no clues at all. I'm fed up of giving the bottles away. You've got to sweat a little.
And so I thought I'd impress the guy from CBS when he came. And he came along at 8 o'clock on the Friday night. And BBC Radio Birmingham's rock show of the time, which was a show called Heavy Pressure, presented by a guy called Malcolm Jay.
The thing was that with such a big group like Led Zeppelin, you've got three characters, Page, Plant and Bonham.
They were doing a live OB for, this is quite something actually, back in the day. They were doing a live OB of the Straubs in concert at Birmingham Town Hall.
Amazed at what I am, I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man.
So I thought I'll have that on, so make it look as if I've got my finger on the pulse. And I quite like the Strawbs, actually. So they came, and it was actually the guy I'd seen at the first interview, plus the promotions manager, because the person they were hiring would report to the sales manager, but also do work for the promotions manager. I said, oh, I'm just listening to Radio Birmingham and the Strawbs, and they went, fine. So I turned it down, and we chatted, and then they offered me the job. And I started on April the 9th, 1973. They had a really scruffy office in John Bright Street in the centre of Birmingham. I was supposed to be doing a lot of sales stuff for the sales manager, but he really actually wanted me to make a cup of tea occasionally and take a few sales figures. But other than that, most of my stuff was for the promotions guy. And that's where I got into, I was quite interested in radio anyway. He was only plugging BBC local radio in those days, so there wasn't an awful lot around, but that was my first, or the way things started for me.
And now, the last in the present series of Pebble Mill at One.
The promo guy led a very colourful life, really. One of the first things I remember, on my second day, he took me down to the BBC at Pebble Mill. He introduced me to the guys that he used to plug at Pebble Mill at One. I sat in the studio. In fact, I sat in the gallery when the show went out live on air, and I was convinced the director was going to have some sort of heart attack or seizure because I'd never seen anybody get so frantic. It was live TV for 45 minutes, so it was quite something, really. For the next sort of 12 months, as I say, most of the time, I used to either be in the office or I'd go with the promo man to Radio Birmingham. I don't think I went anywhere further than Radio Birmingham, and occasionally went up to the old ATV building. Because there wasn't much radio, one of the key things was to make sure he had a very good sort of mailing list and relationship with the local sort of club DJs across the Midlands area. Quite a few of the locally based ones used to come into the office. And one of the first club DJs I met was Pete Waterman, who was then the resident DJ, I think, at the Locarno in Coventry and Mr. George's in Coventry. Pete was a hell of a character and still is. Absolutely fantastic knowledge of music. His speciality then was soul music and a lot of the catalogue that CBS had, but they were sitting on and not releasing. And he used to sort of, like, you know, run his own little campaigns to try and get CBS to release a track. And I mean, in the end, sort of through his feedback and others, there were one or two tracks that did come out. And I think he was very much sort of behind making CBS wake up to the fact they own the Philadelphia International catalogue.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed.
They'd already started releasing stuff by the OJs and Billy Paul, but they gave the Philly label its own identity, obviously, onwards from there, and it became quite an established label in the UK as well as America.
War and poverty.
After doing that for about 18 months or so, they were looking to expand the regional promotions team so that in each area, there was one guy that used to do radio and TV, and then I would be doing the clubs. I'd take over that side of things, press. Oh, in the end, I did BBC local radio because commercial radio had just started. Because I always remember meeting John Russell before BR&B opened, because he came over to the office and he went out for lunch with the promotions manager at the time. They came back and he introduced me. This is John Russell, who's going to be running the new commercial radio station in Birmingham.
Radio stations are rather like restaurants. If you go to a restaurant and you have a bad time, bad meal or bad service, you never go back because there are plenty of other restaurants.
I was brought in to shore up the team and do other things so that, you know, the other guy could concentrate on doing sort of commercial radio and stuff. But in the end, I found myself doing virtually all the radio because He was sometimes doing other things. Somebody else came in to do that job, but I used to help him out. I got on very well with him. I used to sort of go out on the road a lot with a lot of bands who were playing university and college circuit in those days. There were loads of gigs in those days. I used to sort of be attached sometimes to bands for, you know, a period of time, you know, where I'd follow the tour around, you know, sort of. So in our area, I think there was BR&B, Radio Trent, obviously, that came on air, Swansea Sound, and Radio Orwell. God help you if you were ever going from Swansea Sound to Radio Orwell. I don't think we ever did that trip, actually. It would take you days back in the day.
Good morning, my name's Kevin Morrison and I'm pleased to be one of the first to welcome you to BRMB, the new independent radio station in Birmingham. Well, I'm going to be here every morning from now on helping you to start your day the BRMB way, and I hope you're going to make it a habit, because, as our theme will tell you, it's the sound way to spend your day.
I was in BR&B on the opening day, the day they went on air, and it was my one memory is that the place was a real mess because they hadn't really got the building properly together. I do remember being ever so excited about BR&B, Birmingham having its own commercial radio station. I actually got up really early to actually hear it go on air. Basically, Kevin Morrison used to do the breakfast show, and it was commercial radio, but not as we know it. But basically, yeah, it was strange BR&B was in the early days. During the daytime, eventually, I mean, all those people connected with their audience, and they were yeah, really great broadcasters in their own way, I suppose. But for me, I mean, it was in the evenings when Robin Velt came on that I got more interested in what, like, he was playing, and that sounded more like what I'd heard of commercial radio elsewhere. I didn't actually sort of plug it in those days, but I'd heard Piccadilly, and of course Piccadilly sounded sort of, you know, quite sort of slick in those days, sort of, certainly that's what it seemed. But Trent as well was a different beast, wasn't it? Because Trent was sort of, you know, they had Kid Jensen on that morning show. And
musically, early 75 was a little slow, but made up for it in the latter half with a lot of exciting albums and new talents to emerge. My favorite albums coming from Eddie Howell, Thin Lizzy, and just lately Santana. 1975 saw the birth of Radio Trent. And 1976 will most certainly be 301's coming-of-age period.
It was run much more like a commercial radio station, how I expected it to be. And then Swansea Sound, obviously. I can't remember whether Colin Mason was there right from day one or not. I really can't remember. But there was a character as well, you know, sort of with his territorial army background as well. You know, it was just amazing. He brought in some really good people, though, into radio, if you think about it. I remember the sort of days at sort of places like BR&B and some of the other big city stations where they would only see record pluggers on a certain day, and in BR&B's case, on a certain morning. I mean, Trent used to do the same, where it was Wednesdays where you used to be able to get in to see the head of music, but woe betide you if you tried to go any other day, you wouldn't be able to go. Just completely, you know, closed door to record pluggers. I mean, I remember sort of going to Radio Trent, and obviously in the really early days, John Barter. John was a ex-Luxembourg man, wasn't he? And he was an unlikely sort of, very nice man, but an unlikely sort of head of music for a radio station. He was the acceptable sort of friendly face, but, you know, sort of basically that was it. And I remember going, I mean, it was a 150-odd-mile drive to get to Swansea, and appointments used to last about 5 minutes. It was just sort of crazy. 257 Swansea Sound.
Florida.
Yeah, and I also remember, you know, Martin Sutton at BR&B, Brian Savin at BR&B, who was head of music for a fair few years there. I always remember me taking a Clash record into Brian, and he got the, it was in the days still of vinyl, and he got the Clash record. I can't remember which one it was. It was one of the early ones, like White Riot or something like that. And he got it, put it on the floor, and ran over it with his chair, saying, "I don't think we'll be needing that." Because obviously they didn't have the tools that are available today in terms of, you know, I mean, then again, I mean, I would actually sort of say that sometimes some of those tools that are available are sometimes overworked today, you know, sort of. But then it was relying probably totally on gut instinct, and also maybe artists they thought might work. And there were records that did come. That was in the days when, in the mid to late 70s, where commercial radio did break a lot of records, you know, sort of for record labels. Radio 1 was starting to get into disarray, and obviously commercial and local commercial was the thing. Obviously, after that first batch of stations came on stream, the first 19, you know, it looked for a little while because there were no new stations for a few years, were there? But then obviously more came on, probably about 1980, would it be? And then went on from there. But just to go back, I mean, I can't, that thinking of characters, I mean, the characters who ran Beacon Radio in Wolverhampton, I mean, Jay Oliver and Alan McKenzie, I mean, were, you have to mention them because they were just, you know, sort of in a different ballpark to everybody else in terms of the way they operated. I mean, they were certainly sort of very, you know, open to, I mean, they were always pushing the fact that obviously people should advertise on the station. They were in your face about, you know, hey, when was it since CBS advertised on this station? And, you know, it was in the days when record companies did a lot of advertising on commercial radio. There were one or two of the pluggers who did have a little bit of sort of sway or control on a budget to actually spend on radio. So you've got to be very careful where that line is drawn, really. I mean, we didn't do that, but obviously, you know, generally I fed back, you know, that I was getting a lot of stick over. I mean, they were particularly upset when a campaign went to BR&B and didn't go to Beacon, because obviously people would buy Birmingham radio but wouldn't necessarily buy Wolverhampton-based radio. Even though, I mean, it was a hell of a sort of a, as you well know, it was a hell of a TSA. They were very active as well at attending industry events, where sometimes, you know, elsewhere people wouldn't be quite so active sometimes. So they were always trying to sort of do their own bit to promote sort of Beacon. And they were just amazing characters. You probably had to meet them to believe them, really. But there's nobody like that around these days.
The music on Beacon is going to cover a much wider spread than I think people have been accustomed to on radio generally, in that we are going to split our music into four categories: singles, albums, super gold or oldies, and breakers. The singles will, to a large extent, reflect national single sales, while at the same time also show the influence of the people who work for Beacon. The albums will be much along the same line. The oldies will obviously reflect the tastes that all of us have had over the years, from 1956 through until about 6 months ago. And the breakers will be a chance for new material, both new material from the area and, of course, from all over the world. A chance for new artists to find out if their type of music will be liked by the listeners to Beacon.
If you think about the number of stations that were around, there was a lot of driving and very few sort of radio interviews, really. Also, it was quite common in those days that for every radio tour that I did, I had a cool box that I used to stock up with loads of cans of beer. And they'd basically sort of, like, you know, drink their way around the country, really. And then we'd stop at a pub and have lunch and, you know. So basically they were quite sort of boozy affairs, really. And that's not even mentioning some of the substances that got sort of used. It might not by me, I hasten to say, but I can, and I'm not naming names, but there are in those days, you know, sort of, you know, even smoking a cigarette obviously was sort of perfectly acceptable in somebody else's car. You know, they were quite sort of you know, wild affairs, but there were certainly, you know, sort of there were distractions for the artist, whereas these days, I mean, like, you know, you'd stop for a bottle of water or whatever, or go to Marks and Spencer's, you know. So it's like that, you know, it's different completely. I did radio tours with a number of artists, but I did drive Michael Jackson and I did take him to BRMB, and that was a unique experience because obviously not many people come that close to somebody like that. It wasn't relatively early in his career. I mean, he hadn't actually embarked on his solo career then. He was making the Off the Wall album. We negotiated the fact that he would do this interview for BRMB's morning show, presented by Stuart White in those days. Stuart has it in his Wikipedia that he interviewed Michael Jackson, but I know he hasn't got the audio either, because I think the audio disappeared, along with a lot of other things, when the move was made from Aston Road North. He was a charming guy, and he was only 20 years old in those days. Well, then, and he actually had a fair degree of eccentricity to him then. But he was always interested in people. He was asking questions about you know, my family. And on the way back, he wanted to go shopping. So I'd been told by the head office at the time, if it's Michael Jackson, don't go in your Cortina. Hire a Granada. So there was I, my hired Ford Granada with Michael Jackson and his manager at the time, a guy called Freddie DeMann, who is a very well-known American manager, and up till very recently was still managing Jennifer Lopez, Shakira, and one or two others. As I say, we did the live interview at BRMB. Then he wanted to go shopping, so I took him into Corporation Street in the centre of Birmingham. Parked on double yellow lines because I thought, can't make Michael Jackson walk. I mean, there was just the three of us, and we went into one store just for a look around, and then we went to a branch of Tandy's in Corporation Street, because at that time Tandy's sold records. They had a small record department. It was the wrong record department to go into, because for one thing, obviously Michael was touring with the Jacksons at that time. Freddie obviously was their manager, and they didn't have the latest album in stock, for one thing. Freddie was quite wound up. Michael wasn't worried, but I don't know, when he got back to his hotel, he put a sort of fairly strong phone call into the CBS office. But Michael wanted some cassettes for his Walkman. I'd never seen a Walkman before, but he had this cassette Walkman. He wanted to get the cassette of the movie about bunny rabbits, which turned out to be the soundtrack to Watership Down.
Be cunning, full of tricks, and your people will never be destroyed.
Well, he didn't buy anything. He helped himself to about sort of 7 or 8 cassettes. Didn't expect to pay for them. So I said to the guy, look, you know, I'll arrange for us to do a swap on the stock that we've taken, and you know, I'll come back, and which I did do later on that day. You know, it was just a surreal experience. Even though Michael Jackson was a star then, he wasn't the megastar he became. So he was able to walk around without being really bothered. Somebody reminded me the other day on Facebook that they'd posted, I once had coffee with Celine Dion. And I do remember now that we did do a radio tour in her early days. I think it was Where Does My Heart Beat Now was the single, which was initially wasn't a hit, but then I think it came back to be a hit once she'd broken through. But we did a radio tour where we went to exotic locations like Stoke-on-Trent and It was actually sort of difficult to get her into places because she was actually a brand new artist who the chairman of Sony at the time, Paul Berger, was massively behind because he was an American who, prior to coming to the UK, was running the Canadian company where she was obviously their biggest act. She was really nice and really good to work with, and I worked with her again subsequently on two or three other occasions. And she always remembered the early days, and she was really sort of fine, but she never did anything like that again in terms of going to radio. And, you know, I think I got her onto the John Tainton show on the network, BBC, in the evening and stuff like that.
I was with the rival commercial station, BRMB, at the time, doing news and current affairs. And I was invited to join WM, and I was delighted to do so.
She did a showcase, I think, in Birmingham. Then we went down to do John's show, you know, and obviously she never did anything like that again in terms of radio touring. But, you know, she always remembered doing it. So I found that quite nice, the fact that she did remember it. And actually, I'll tell a little story here, because there was an artist who won, I think she won Opportunity Knox, Huey Green's talent show, the forerunner of all those talent shows. And there was a lady called Tammy Jones won the show. Let Me Try Again was the single. And I think she'd won the show sort of for about 5 or 6 weeks running or something. When we did a radio tour, and we did all the Welsh station. Well, say all the Welsh. We did Swansea Sound, and I think we did BBC Radio Wales. And there wasn't much else to do in those days. And we did the stations across the Midlands. But she was one of the most difficult sort of people I've worked with. I was probably too naive then to realise quite why she was so difficult. Anyways, we sort of struggled through, and we did. And we were doing press then as well, so most sort of tours weren't just radio. It did include quite often a boozy lunch with some local journalist who sort of, by having a, you know, couple of beers and a spot of lunch, used to write a favourable piece in the local paper. But I do remember that my late mother was a big fan of Tammy Jones. She said, "I'd love to meet her. Could I meet her?" I said, "Well, knowing that, you know, Tammy wasn't particularly my favourite artist, I thought I'd better make sure my mother does meet her, but I hope it goes well." She was back in the Midlands, and we still had that regional office, because the regional office that went on for about sort of 5 or 6 years, we had the office. And Tammy was coming in to do a couple of press phoners while she was in the area into Birmingham office. So I thought that was the ideal time for my mother to come in and meet her. So my mum came in all excited, and Tammy came in. So I introduced them, and she said, my mother said to Tammy, because she was really gushing, because she was really excited, she said, "Do you know, Tammy, I love your music. I love your record. Do you know, I play it and play it every Sunday morning, and our Robert says, get that rubbish off." I didn't quite know where to put myself at that point, but she was right. I did say that.
"I know I said that I was leaving, but I just couldn't say goodbye."
You do get people who behave oddly in front of, you know, big name artists, and if they either go into a radio station or if you're at, you know, a radio station event. I do remember many years ago taking Shakin' Stevens in his heyday to Beacon. The weather hadn't been so good, so Beacon had actually got the fans inside reception to wait for him. And unfortunately, one of the fans was so excited, she actually threw up over the reception desk. There's one or two people actually in radio stations who work at the station who sometimes they're totally sort of normal, sane people you've always thought, but when confronted by someone who is a fairly big star, do unpredictable things. And I've had an afternoon presenter at a radio station in recent years thrust a baby into the arms of a certain band and had a photo taken with them, you know, sort of their baby with sort of the band, because they actually, and you would never have dreamt the person would be doing this, you know, but I was at, a couple of years ago, I was at Key 103 with Shane Filan. Shane, because of his time in Westlife, you know, still got this hell of a following that sort of, you know, go around. And he's really, really sort of talented and nice chap. He's really, really good. And he'll go out and chat. And basically, there'll be a line of fans. There was probably about 150 fans outside with one lady who brought her baby along, who the baby must have been 2 weeks old. And she came along with baby, gives the baby to Shane, photo opportunity. And you're thinking, it's weird, isn't it, how people do this, you know? But you would never dream of doing it. But then I suppose maybe it's a big deal, you know? So, you know, they've met Shane Filan and he's had his photo taken with the baby. But you wouldn't drag a baby of 2 weeks old to do that, you know? So it's really sort of strange, really odd. There's loads of scary fan stories. I mean, let's face it, being on the radio, particularly if you're a late night presenter, I mean, I have seen some of the, you know, cakes and all sorts of things that turn up. In the days when radio stations had receptionists or reception areas, there was always someone who used to come in with a cake for the late night presenter or whatever. It's a little bit sort of play misty for me, isn't it, you know? Of the stations I covered, I think Leicester Sound were the first ones to get a CD player in the studio. So, you know, I made sure that they had, you know, CDs.
Living in the 80s, living with Leicester Sound.
But when I went up to the mothership, to Trent, I actually sort of saw Len Grote, so their head of music and senior, whatever he was at the time, and basically Len sort of looked at the CD very suspiciously and said, which side do you play? But he got the hang of it, and you know, CDs obviously became the choice format then, so that was fine. But it was a bit of a shock initially, I think, to the system. But Len was, it was always interesting. He was very good. Actually, Len was really good to me. So he's actually sort of one of the characters that you think about from that era.
Jackson 5 get us into the third hour of a Sunday get-together on this Jubilee weekend, because the song entitled Show Me The Way To Go. Good afternoon to you.
Won't you come on in?
Won't you come on in?
The music's fine.
Weather-wise today, cloudy with our breaks of rain is the forecast, heavy at times, but brighter weather will spread.
Yeah, that was in the days as well, when you were a plugger, that radio stations used to send their playlists through the post to you. On a Friday morning, I used to get through the playlists from various stations in the post. So you'd open them, and there'd be, you know, quite a degree of excitement to see whether either a certain record that you'd plugged earlier that week had made the playlist, or whether you'd got a record of the week, because stations sometimes used to have individual DJs that were picked a record of the week. And it was quite an exciting sort of thing to actually have that through. And even now, I mean, I know this sounds sort of quite sad, but even now when, you know, you get the email through from various stations or groups with the playlist news, you still get, you know, I get quite a kick from just seeing a record that I've plugged get on a playlist, you know. So, I mean, in our heyday at Sony, we were putting out sometimes 7 or 8 records a week, and we'd have about 15 what were called work or priority records that were already, like, in there from previous weeks. And then each week, another six or seven sometimes got added as new releases to the mix. There were some records there that should never have been released, but you just had no choice but to actually work them. There are still records out there that should never be released, but the quality control is much greater now. And there are loads of good records out there that unfortunately still don't get exposure. But in those days, I mean, good grief, there were hundreds of records like sort of that a station could possibly list. And there were loads of records that, you know, maybe were really good records, but because there were just so many around at the time, even with considerably bigger playlists than today, stations could never get to grips with playing. It is difficult. I mean, I don't have that problem now, because being independent, I can have, you know, the quality control is with me to a point, because there are sort of certain records that I don't do. If I don't like them, I'm given excuses to why. I mean, there's very odd occasions where I have said that, well, I'm sorry, I don't like it. But quite often, you know, there's also other valid reasons for not, you know, doing a record. But when I was working for the company, then you didn't have a choice. I mean, and if a certain A&R man believed in his acts and believed that that act's record was the right record to release, you were stuck with it. And obviously that's where it does get quite difficult. But with most people, because you'd built up that relationship, they wouldn't know if I was actually sort of, you know, not into something or like. So my approach has always been quite low-key anyway, sort of. And basically, you know, they would know straight away from the look in my eye what I personally thought of a record. But there were certain things or certain, you know, sort of people that you could always count on for obviously seeing you through on a particular project if it was a particularly important one. And sometimes that did come into play. But, you know, that very rarely, I think, has happened, you know, recently, you know, sort of. I think that's something that, partly because I think quality control is a lot better these days, you know. So there's still a lot of records around. Companies like a Sony had the contractual obligation sort of records, you know, sort of, and also the records that meant that if they put out sort of the top acts from Denmark, then they would obviously get a release in Denmark for whichever UK act they wanted to release there, you know. In fact, several UK acts, as long as they kept that company or that territory sort of sweet, you know.
The split is coming. From April the 4th, BRMB will be exclusively on FM 96.4. On AM medium wave 1152 will be Extra AM playing classic oldies.
People like the like Robin Vaught, for instance, at BRMB when he was doing the evening sort of rock show, as they called it. I mean, a lot of the interviews he did were really good with particular artists. I mean, it was always obviously, you know, an artist that, you know, because basically if he didn't particularly like the artist, he wouldn't do it, which is fair enough. I'd rather have that situation, because that's when you sometimes get, or used to sometimes get, the, you know, the worst interview around, the one where somebody had done you a favour, supposedly, and it used to end up, you know, being something dreadful. But Robin's interviews were always good, because, you know, he did what he rated and what he liked and stuff.
Genius of Eric Carmen from his brand new album, and that's Sunrise. Good morning, sunshine. This is Beacon, and it's 6:07.
West Midlands. Yeah, Mike Baker, the late Mike Baker. I mean, he was so good. I mean, he actually put Beacon Radio on air. He was the first voice on Beacon, and obviously he went through probably most of the shows on Beacon. When he was doing his late show, he played some brilliant music. I mean, he'd never be able to do it now, but he used to play sort of loads of tracks from albums. And, you know, there were albums I went out and acquired, or I don't think I bought any, but I acquired some that I heard on Mike's show. But in his heyday at Beacon, I thought he was an excellent presenter and a great interviewer as well, you know. I actually met a guy recently, actually, in the last sort of 6-7 weeks, where I took a new band, a newish band, into Radio Lincolnshire. And I think, the guy there, Rob Makepeace, he really impressed me, because he knew his music. He obviously knows his sport, because that's his line. But there was also, you know, when there's something about someone that you think, yeah, you could actually sort of develop into something quite nicely. You could actually develop your career well. There are numerous, other people around the country who actually sort of are really good at what they do. I mean, I really rate Alex James, who works for, I think he's at Radio City now, but I mean, obviously he was on Bauer's In Demand show for a number of years. And the problem is in commercial radio is that at the BBC, you do have the benefit of a producer for each show, and whereas commercial radio, at some of them, you're self-producing, or at best, if you're a breakfast presenter, you might have a producer, perhaps. But it's a lot more difficult sometimes to get the right direction, maybe.
And tonight, folk from Planxty, Richard Digents and Steele Ice Band, reggae from Clint Eastwood and General Saint, jazz rock with Paraphernalia and 20th Century Blues, a couple of Cajun tracks, also the Incredible String Band.
There were also, I mean, the late John Shaw, what an interviewer he was, he could have done sort of things, on probably national radio if he'd have been the sort of character, but it would have been wonderful to have seen him do that. Dean Jackson is unique. I mean, he's been doing that show on Radio Nottingham for 25 years. I can't remember. There was a significant anniversary a while back, but I remember when he started that show. Even now, he's sort of doing sort of new bands and giving new bands a break on that show, both locally and from other areas as well. And he's done, sort of fantastically well for sort of working on and helping to break, new talent. Oh, when
you choose. So who was it that said, Jake, you can sing? The Family?
Yeah, that was about it. That's who I first played to. I first started writing about 14, but I started playing at about 12.
I think now, sort of currently, there are a number of really good interviewers around on commercial radio and on BBC local radio. I mean, what helps people these days a little bit is the fact that tool, the internet, is sort of gives people such an insight and an angle, even unusual angle sometimes, on certain acts, so whether they're name acts or not so well known. That wasn't there, obviously, all those years ago. I do remember that in the early days of Gloria Estefan, she did it wasn't an ISDN session in those days. I think it was when we used to hire Tony Hale's satellite sort of facility, and we'd bounce a few interviews around during the afternoon. And there was someone, I can't remember who it was now, but it was one of the Chiltern group of stations, in where he was convinced that Gloria Estefan was actually Gloria Gaynor. And that was quite embarrassing. There was also an occasion where I was actually in the room where this happened. I won't mention the presenter concerned, but it was a radio station in the Stoke-on-Trent area that's a commercial radio station. And basically, I'd gone in there with Spandau Ballet, who were still very, very... They weren't at the height of their success, because they'd moved from Chrysalis to Sony. And I think at Sony, we had one hit through the barricades and very little else. But they're really nice guys. It was, the Kemp brothers, the traditional lineup of Spandau Ballet. And I think we were with Tony Hadley and Gary Norman. And for some reason, the presenter thought that Gary Norman was Gary Kemp. And it got very embarrassing until I had to sort of stop the interview. And basically, outside, they went into fits of laughter. And luckily, the on their bus, I don't know whether they still do this, but at the time, the one movie they used to play constantly was Spinal Tap.
Just kick my ass, okay? Kick this ass for a man, that's all. Kick my ass. Enjoy. Come on. I'm not asking, I'm telling with this. Kick my ass.
I reenacted the part of Artie Puffkin, where is the plugger who sets up the really lousy in-store, and they kicked my ass. So basically that... So they took it in good sort of spirit, but it was embarrassing, I have to say. I always remember an instance where Beacon were doing a show at the, I think it was the Wolfram Hall in Wolverhampton, with numerous artists obviously quickly doing sort of PAs on and off stage. I remember it was the first time that I'd ever seen Anton Deck, actually. But the Pasadenas did that because it was while I was at Sony. And whichever playout system we used or was used that night, whether it was DAT or CD or whatever, and halfway through it just ground to a halt, stopped, and that was that, you know. So it all got a bit sort of embarrassing, but that does happen at several events. I was at an event recently with Scouting for Girls where it was a radio gig and they had a power cut, you know, halfway. They were playing live and there was a power cut halfway through the gig and it stopped the show for 15 minutes, you know. So, you know, sometimes these things happen.
When I was young, I never knew what this thing called love could do to you. But since you've been gone,
if you actually sort of looked in the boot of my car now, what was then... I mean, it used to be a standing joke at every station had someone who used to say, what have you got in the boot today, Bob? And you'd end up going out to the car and, you know, the boot would be raided and everybody would be smiling and happy. Well, now you'll find probably nothing other than my grandson's sort of child seat or something or other. It's sort of totally different. Even when I first went independent about 11 years ago, for the first couple of years on a new release single, I would be sending out a couple of hundred CD singles. Now I send out, I think there are 18 people who say they like hard copy records. The rest is all, I send them a link or it's an e-card or whatever system that particular company use. So do you go with a record straight away because it's up there on iTunes and might get a big sort of early kick up the charts if it's a fan base record? Or do you think it's a fan base record and don't? Or do you wait a couple of weeks till it gets closer to the impact date where more of the big activity promotion-wise is around the record, and do you add it then? What do you do? I don't know. It's different for each station or group, really, the way they tend to work it. It's still really, with a lot of people, back to the traditional system where you might start to slowly warm it up and build. In a lot of cases, you're looking for big old sort of first week on a record, so... It varies. I made a list quite recently, actually, of the number of stations that or groups that you have out there where someone makes a decision on whether a record gets played or not. And there are actually still over 40 places where that happens. I'm talking in regional radio terms. Of that 40... there are some of those stations in more remote locations. They're still making their decisions, so fair enough. You obviously sort of need to sort of make sure that they have your record. But if you sort of narrow it down, you can get a much smaller list of the places where, you know, obviously it really counts to get on there, you know. So it is actually... It gets more difficult as time goes on, but, you know, that's the nature of the beast. I mean, we were saying that 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and we will continue to say that.
So it is coming up to 4 o'clock, and you know what that means? We've been building up to it all week, and I'm very excited about this. Greg James is going to be here with the official chart. It's been on Sundays for pretty much ever. Now it is part of your Friday afternoon.
I mean, obviously... I sit in meetings where there's the national radio plugger and me as the regional radio plugger. And then we might be outnumbered sort of 3-1 by social media people and whatever, which I realise is very important. Obviously, it depends how the label themselves look at it, and I think they still realise that radio is ultra important because it's still the main source of... I mean, there's some. I mean, there's a lot of kids who go somewhere else to hear their new music these days, but you know, to the mainstream and you know, sort of the wider sort of audience, I think radio is still, you know, ultra important, and I think the labels still recognise this. Well, they're still paying me.
Live across the UK, capital London.
Here we go.
Your downloads contains the chart. This is officially.
The recent years where I've been sort of going to stations the length and breadth of the UK, even though it's been probably harder work from the point of view of doing that and doing radio tours and stuff and doing sort of sometimes a week or 2 weeks, it is really, really hard work. But I've enjoyed it far more being independent than being in the corporate world. It's way, way better because A, the fact you get to choose who you work with, you know, sort of, you also sometimes, well, let's face it, when you actually spend even a week on the road with an artist, you get to know them better than some of the people who are working, or most of the people working at the label, because you're with them, you're living with them for a week almost in a way.
When I was a boy, I saw my daddy crying at the steering wheel, and oh.
A couple of weeks ago, I was truly delighted when Rick Astley held off Tom O'Dell to be number one in the album chart, and I've been even more sort of pleased that last week, you know, he didn't keep top spot because you seldom do, but he still stayed top three with the album, so the sales held up. In fact, I think the sales might have been slightly up from the previous week. And even now, you know, he's up there at number four. You know, it's still really... I'm really pleased about that because he deserves everything because he did the whole album himself, played everything, wrote everything. You know, it's fantastic, and he's such a nice guy to boot. So that's great. However, I take more probably pleasure from looking at the airplay chart, you see. So basically, it's great to get a number one record, but for me, it's more about, you know, the part you play in getting a record, you know, exposed, really. So I've had a great time, you know. So I still want to keep on doing it sort of for a bit longer yet as well. I don't know. I think I've been sort of myself, really, because I think sometimes, and don't get me wrong, I mean, there are some people who actually do a brilliant job being sort of, you know, very sort of almost like acting the part, really, whereas I've always been myself, you know, and I think people had to watch my kids grow up in some ways, because I remember years ago when my kids were small, I used to take them occasionally, particularly at weekends. I mean, because radio stations were open at weekends in those days, you actually went in and there were people, yeah, the programme director or head of music might not have been there, but, you know, there'd be live DJs on air and stuff. So basically, you know, I sometimes used to take them into places and people used to see that as well. I think it helped cultivate this image of, hey, he's quite real. No, I don't know. I'm just guessing at that. I don't know. But I really sort of like will miss that if I at some point decide to pack it all in. But that's why I'm going to carry on for a while, you see. Yeah, I'd like to be remembered as someone who actually played some sort of part in the radio station, whichever radio station it is, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of being a useful link to them, to the record industry and to them, basically. And hopefully that was, or is, the case.
Thank you.